Okay, recording in progress. All right, so this will be the last class of the season, and will be the last class that we have on this Zoom link. We will resume, God willing, in the fall, right after the Yom Tovim. So actually not in September, probably the first week of October. For the folks here in New Rochelle, we'll learn on Monday nights at Anshe Shalom. And for the Woodmere crowd, anybody else who wants on Zoom, it'll be Tuesday nights, back to the old Tuesday night routine at 8:15. Okay, so our topic for tonight, to sum up, will be demographic, religious, and cultural trends in recent American Jewish history. So let's talk about demographics first. Much of this course was dedicated to the story of Jewish immigration to America. And in fact, the periodization of American Jewish history is largely determined by great waves of immigration. So you have the Sephardic period, the German period, the Eastern European period, and that's how we covered 300 years worth of time. But in the post-Holocaust era, post-World War II era, you do have several distinct groups of Jewish immigrants that don't necessarily correspond to different chronological waves, but can be identified by place of origin and the cultural baggage that they bring with them. So I want to identify seven different groups. The first one, of course, are the Holocaust survivors, who we will call this 1945 to 1953. When I give those years, 53 is pretty late in the game, but bear in mind there were plenty of people who were DPs in Europe or even who settled in Europe but didn't want to be there, wanted to come to the United States, but getting a visa was no simple task, and they waited years and years and years. And so it wasn't until the early 50s that the last of those people who really wanted to go were able to make it to America. Of course, those who were lucky were able to get out of Europe pretty quickly after the war. So you did have Holocaust survivors as early as late 1945, although most did not come till 46, 47. What did this wave of immigrants bring to the United States as far as American Jewry is concerned? So first of all, it brought this significant numbers of Hasidim, which we really didn't have in America before the war. Yes, there was some Lubavitch, there were even some Transylvanian Hasidim, some Ukrainian Hasidim who were in America as early as the 1890s. But you didn't have serious Hasidic communities in the United States until after the war. This is a product of the Holocaust survivor, the Shirita Pleita experience. Most importantly, the big groups that exist today, the biggest of all being Satmar, was a non-factor in this country until after the war. And they become entrenched in the ethnic enclaves in Brooklyn and in other areas around New York City. One of the other things that the Holocaust survivor group brought to the to American Judaism was religious functionaries. And I don't just mean, rabbis, because in fact, rabbis like congregational rabbis, that has to have American training, and the survivor group is not going to include those types of people. Rather, I'm talking about teachers in the day schools, in the Talmud Torahs, in the yeshivas. They were in short supply prior to the war. But after the war, there were plenty of people who could teach yeshiva. Also, moalim, shochtim, religious functionaries who did specific tasks that may have been in demand but in short supply prior to the war, now were in tremendous supply because the survivors, many of them went into the ethnic economy and did reasonably well for themselves in the process. Okay, so that's the first group. The second group, and by the way, tonight I'm only going to spend maybe 1 or 2 minutes on each of these subtopics, each one of which could be its own lecture, but we don't have time to cover all these topics in great depth, but I want to just mention all those that seem reasonably important. The next group are those who come as a result of the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. This was not a large group, but it did have some impact on American Jewish life and American Judaism. What religious innovation is most associated with the 1956 arrival of Hungarian Jews in America? Which religious innovation?
Chandeliers?
No, you have one choice. One, 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 one.
Glad kosher.
Glad kosher. Bingo. Who got that right? Who was that?
Me. The Yankee.
Okay, all right. So glad kosher. As our good congregant here, David Tantliff, says, he was in yeshiva in the mid-1950s in Brooklyn, and a rebbe said, "Vos meint glatt kosher? Either this is kosher, or this is nit kosher. Either it's kosher or it's not kosher. So what does glatt kosher mean?" It was an invention of the late 50s as a result of the Hungarian influence. Again, this group also brought its fair share of yeshiva teachers, shochtim, and even Hasidic rabbis, not necessarily grand rabbis, but rabbis who played a role in the ethnic enclaves of Brooklyn. Okay, the next group to come to the United States, I will say, was 1967 to roughly 1969. And these are Jews who come from Eastern Bloc countries, whether it was Hungary or Czechoslovakia or Poland. And it's the result of turmoil in the Eastern Bloc, where there's agitation against communist rule for more greater freedoms. And Jews, having found that the greater freedoms are not going to be found there, are looking to get out. Part of the of this discussion is a backlash to the Six-Day War. You know, there is Zionist ferment after the Six-Day War, even in Eastern countries, especially in Poland. But yet, the Goyim and the government don't want to see this, don't like it one bit. And there's persecution of Jews in communist countries in the late 60s in conjunction with the Zionist aftermath of the Six-Day War and the 68 turmoil. So Jews leave. Where do they go? Well, some go to Israel, if they can get there, and others go to the United States, most of them moving to New York. Especially Queens, and especially, you know, central Queens, like, you know, Forest Hills, Rego Park, Kew Gardens area. The next group we'll say is Soviet Jewry. But Soviet Jewry is a hodgepodge of different types of Jewry. And when do they arrive? So people like to think of the mass wave of Soviet Jewry coming to either Israel or to the Western countries, the United States, with the fall of the Soviet Union, or at least the end of the Cold War with Glasnost, Perestroika, 1989 and onward. But to be fair, there were Soviet Jews coming to America as early as the early 1970s. And we ought to spend a few moments discussing the Jackson-Vanik Amendment to the 1972 trade agreement. So Henry Scoop Jackson, the senator, and Representative Charles Vanik operated in the Congress, in the House and the Senate, to disadvantage certain countries for their mistreatment of Jews. That the most favored nation status, which was being conferred by the United States government on certain non-market economies, meaning communist economies, in order to facilitate trade, that's a favor that the United States is doing to these countries. But those who were in Congress and pro-Jewish wanted to see that tied to freedom of movement, freedom of emigration for Jews who are struggling and suffering under communist rule. Richard Nixon did not like this idea because he was pursuing detente with Brezhnev in the summer of 1972, prior to his re-election, and then even after his re-election. And Henry Kissinger famously or infamously said, "It doesn't matter to us whether the Soviets put the Jews in gas chambers. It's not our problem." This was the most anti-Semitic comment that Henry Kissinger was ever caught making. And he did not want the superpower relationship at all compromised by some senator and congressman pursuing things that are advantageous for the Jews, but annoying to American foreign policy. Well, ultimately, Nixon disappears from the scene after Watergate and resigns August 9th, 1974, and Gerald Ford becomes president. And Ford was willing to sign into law in January of 1975 the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which did pressure the Soviets on the immigration issue. Did it have a real-world impact? Not much of one, to be honest. it was more a matter of for the historical record that Gentile members of the House and Senate were fighting the good fight on behalf of Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, than it actually had a real world impact. All right, but in any event, there was a trickle of Jewish immigration from the Soviet Union to the United States. It was in the 1970s, almost exclusively an Ashkenazic Russian immigration, meaning sort of the white Jews from the westernmost parts of Russia, the European parts of Russia. But as we move along into the 1980s, and certainly after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, this this Russian Jewish immigration to the United States will include a substantial amount of non-Ashkenazic Jews, namely Georgian, Bukharian, from Kazakhstan, from all the Stan countries and the Caucasus countries. And this Jewish community plays a significant role in American Jewish life today, especially in New York and especially in Brooklyn and Queens. It was a community that came to the United States with its religious fervor very much a question mark, but which has become much more religiously observant and spiritually oriented over the past 20 years, courtesy of outreach work. A rare example of a Jewish community that became more religious, not less religious, as a result of the American experience. Okay, the next group, and a group close to my heart for all us Greatneckers out there, okay, we've got a bunch of Greatneck people on the line tonight, is, of course, Persian Jewry. So Persian Jews had already been coming to the United States well before the collapse of the Shah. There were Jews in Greatneck, Persian Jews already from the 1950s. I mean, certainly the Aryeh family came very early on, representing the Shah in a diplomatic sphere. But the community was small but existing in the 1970s. And then 1979, with the fall of the Shah, the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini, so a substantial number of Jews need to leave Iran. Where do they go? Some go to Israel, whether directly or indirectly, via Turkey. Others go to Italy, but many go to the United States. Where do they go? Basically three places. Either Los Angeles, where there is a substantial Persian community, even of non-Jews, of Zoroastrians too, and Muslims, or they go to New York. Where in New York? Whether Central Queens or Long Island, namely Greatneck, Kings Point, and Roslyn. The Persian community, similar to the other non-Ashkenazic communities that came from the Soviet Union, arrived in this country without much religious attachment. I mean, yes, there was cultural Judaism, but not much observant orthodoxy. And yet that has dramatically changed over the last several decades, courtesy of outreach work, much of it which was done not by Sephardic Jews, but by Ashkenazic Jews. Okay. The next group I'll mention are the Syrian Jews. There had been Syrian Jews in the United States ever since 1907. Okay, my grandmother, growing up in East New York, remembered the so-called Spanish Jews. And there were some who were actually Spanish Jews, but there were others who were really Syrian Jews, but she didn't know the difference because Ashkenazic Jews think that all non-Ashkenazim are the same. You know, it's sometimes hard to tell when they're the other, what they actually are. But there were Syrian Jews from the early years of the 1900s in New York. But in 1992 and 1994, and some of you may have been involved in facilitating this because those of you who are politically active in the community, getting Jews out of Hafez al-Assad's Syria was no simple task. He kept them hostage. But for whatever reason, and there were some ransom and bribe payments, there was an exodus to New York and to Brooklyn and to Flatbush in particular in 92 and 94. Congressman James Scheuer was very involved in this. There were people in the JCRC and in the Conference of Presidents who were involved in making sure that Jews could get out of Syria. Okay, the last group I'll mention, and I won't give years because there really are no years, this is the whole time, are the arrival of Israeli Jews in America. Israeli Jews had been coming to America really since the founding of the state. Some were Americans originally who made Aliyah, whether in the Mandate era or the early state era, but who just didn't stick it out. You know, they made Aliyah, but then they did Yerida. They came back. Others who were not Americans by origin, they came to Eretz Yisrael from many 1,000 other places, but decided to essentially call it quits on Eretz Yisrael, at least for the temporary basis, if not permanent, and made their way to the United States. With the changing of immigration laws in the mid-1960s, it became easier for an Israeli Jew with no American connections to come to the United States and get permanent residency. What was the impact of Israeli Jews on American Jewish life? Well, in some ways, it was significant because Jews need people to teach their kid Hebrew, or to teach their kid Talmud Torah, Hebrew school, or even in yeshiva, in the day schools. And who are you going to hire? So you have to hire somebody to teach the Judaic studies. So it was assumed, whether correctly or incorrectly, that any random Israeli could teach in the day schools. After all, if we're doing Ivrit B'Ivrit, so they have a leg up because they know the language fluently. And even if we're not teaching Ivrit B'Ivrit, they'll pick up English quickly enough, and they'll teach whatever it is our kids need to learn. So the proverbial cab driver from Afula becomes your Hebrew school teacher, the cab driver from Afula. Now, many of these people really were not good teachers, and it was a shame that to rely upon essentially secular Israelis to teach in Orthodox American institutions. But I remember as a kid having such teachers. Some of them were good and some of them weren't so good. But that was in the late 80s, early 90s, but this was already starting in the 1970s. Okay, so another influence of Israelis on American Jewish life was advocacy for Israel, but a more learned advocacy for Israel from people who actually knew what was going on. In other words, not just ignorant Hasbara Zionism by American Jews for American Jews, but an aware Hasbara by people who actually lived and served in the IDF and could speak with knowledge about what's going on in the Middle East.
What about pizza stores and falafel stores?
Bingo. Okay, good. So at the food level, this is a major change. Instead of only having ethnic Ashkenazic cuisine, the likes of Ben's and Siegel's and Epstein's, or on the dairy side, Ratner's, now you could have other kinds of food. So the pizza and falafel places in Kew Garden Hills and elsewhere are all a product of Israeli immigrants to America. And later on, the shawarma places. Shawarma took off 20 years after pizza and falafel. But these places would not exist if not for Israeli immigration to America. And the American Jews took to it very readily and enjoy the food. Okay. Unfortunately, many Israeli Jews in America disappeared from Jewish life. So that it could go in two different directions. Some disappear from Jewish life. So Yossi, who moves from Tel Aviv to Suffolk County, all of a sudden, instead of being Yossi, he's Joe the plumber. And he denies his Jewish and Israeli background and maybe even changes his last name to sound something Goyish or Italian and just blends into the woodwork. But that's one type of Israeli Jew in America. Another type is the Israeli Jew who in Israel had little Judaic attachment, was not a synagogue goer, but doesn't like the idea of thoroughgoing assimilation, wants to preserve something of his ancestral heritage, but in the United States really can only do so in a religious context, namely of synagogue going and sending his kid to a school where they learn religious studies. So for those Israeli American Jews, they become more Jewish and a little bit less Israeli. And that's a favorable outcome as opposed to the Yossi who becomes Joe the plumber. Okay, so all these are different experiences that Jewish immigrants to the United States had over the last 70, 80 years in the post-war era, coming from different backgrounds, different ethnic stock. Okay, let's talk about certain movements that attracted the attention of American Jews in the post-war era. So the big one, of course, is Soviet Jewry. Soviet Jewry was the great struggle that American Jews embarked upon to help their beleaguered brethren overseas. So the big the most significant organization at the grassroots level was Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry, SSSSJ, and founded in 1964 by Jacob Birnbaum. this was a way for the young people, the high school and college age students, the graduate students, to engage in advocacy at the local level, at the national level, for policies that would allow for Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union. Plenty of these people went to Russia to meet with refuseniks, to bring religious articles, a Siddur or Chumash, a pair of tefillin, okay, Hebrew literature, and some people got arrested in the process by Soviet authorities. But the movement was a very important movement. It gave, let's put it this way. For those who were observant Jews, whether Orthodox or even conservative Jews, who were staunchly, religiously Jewish in their personal lives outside of the Soviet Jewry struggle. So this was just like a cherry on the top. But there were plenty of people who were not observant in their personal lives and did not have a real strong Jewish connection in the spiritual realm. But they were for Am Yisrael, and they were against any persecution of Am Yisrael. And so the struggle for Soviet Jewry gave them their Jewish identity. And so that meant protesting at the Isaiah Wall, the Sharansky steps against the United Nations. This was a big deal for a lot of young people. At the more elite level, you have the Appeal of Conscience Foundation. So I, as a former assistant rabbi of Park East Synagogue, would be remiss in my responsibilities if I didn't mention the role Rabbi Arthur Schneier played in all of this. So what was the Appeal of Conscience, the initial appeal? The foundation is Rabbi Schneier's organization, which he uses to interact with high-level people in the diplomatic and religious sphere around the world. But the original appeal was an ad in a newspaper in the New York Times, the weekend of January 17th, 1965. And what was the appeal? An appeal of conscience, that people, all people of good people of faith, of conscience, should rally against the Soviet Union for its mistreatment of Soviet Jews and forbidding them to engage in religious practice, or for that matter, leave the country if they would so like. And who participated in this? So Robert Wagner, the mayor, Martin Luther King Jr. sent a telegram. So heavy hitters in political life and in religious life, from the Catholic Church, the Protestant churches, and elected officials, stood on the steps of Congregation Zichron Ephraim. Now, Zichron Ephraim is today Park East Synagogue, but the name was changed right around that time. It was originally Congregation Zichron Ephraim. Why was it on the steps of Zichron Ephraim? Because what's across the street from Park East Synagogue? On 67th, between Lexington and 3rd, what's across the street?
Soviet embassy.
The Soviet mission, the Russian mission, which was the Soviet mission to the United Nations, was directly across the street. So this was a way of sticking it in the eye of the Russians that, hey, we're going to bring the most important political and religious figures in New York or in America to the steps of a synagogue to wave a finger at you. Shame on you, the Russians. And engraved on the 67th Street side of the synagogue is a plaque. Anyone who's been to Park East knows what does it say on the plaque? Lishmoa and Kat Asir, to hear the cry of the oppressed, from Psalms. It was chiseled onto the side of the synagogue, just directly opposite the entrance to the Russian mission, to show that the Russians are oppressing our people, Am Yisrael, in Russia. So this was the beginnings of a process that would result in many, many trips to the Soviet Union to offer humanitarian supplies and religious articles. And many good, important congregational rabbis over the years got involved, including my rabbi of my childhood, Rabbi Wolf, Ephraim Wolf of the Great Neck Synagogue, would go on secret missions to Russia. Everybody in the Great Neck Synagogue knew it was a secret mission to Russia. So it wasn't such a secret, a mission to Russia. And this was happening on a regular basis. So I see Zach Dicker smiling. You remember Rabbi Wolf? Rabbi Wolf would always go on the secret missions to Russia. Okay, so that was a really important part of Jewish life. I remember as a kid, we're talking now in the mid to late 80s, the Soviet Jewry walkathon, the annual walkathon that they would have, where you would raise money by walking miles and miles around town, and you'd collect money for the sake of beleaguered Jews in the Soviet Union. Another thing that would happen would be the twinning of bar mitzvahs. Who remembers the twinning of bar mitzvahs? That you'd have an American boy having bar mitzvah, let's say Parshas Korach, before, and then you have another boy from the Ukraine, from Moscow, from Leningrad, who was also would have had a bar mitzvah in 1984, but the Russians wouldn't let him have a bar mitzvah. So you would
they mention did bat mitzvah too.
The bat mitzvah too. This is the twinning. Good. So the big rally for the sake of Soviet Jewry, and I'm sure some of you were there, was December 6th, 1987, on the National Mall in Washington. And who was the main speaker? Who was the main speaker? Who remembers? Natan Sharansky. He had gotten out of jail and was released to the Americans over the bridge, okay, West Germany in 1986. Courtesy of important efforts done on his behalf by American Jews and American politicians. And then in 87, the big rally towards the end of the Reagan administration, where 250,000 Jews gathered to hear speeches and to advocate on Israel on behalf of Russian Jews. The next largest rally for Jewish causes was the Intifada era rally, April 15th, 2002, and I'm sure most of you listening tonight were there. I was there, I remember. We went with the Great Neck Synagogue, and that was a major event, 200,000 Jews. So that was second to the Soviet Jewry rally of 87, which was a 250,000. Okay. Another cause, which was not nearly as popular as the Soviet Jewry cause, was that of Ethiopian Jewry. And the North American Conference on Ethiopian Jewry, founded in 1982. Of course, this was mildly controversial in the sense that the Jewish status of Ethiopian Jewry had not yet been decided upon. Of course, the key decision on recognizing the Jewish status was made by Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, the chief rabbi, Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, in 1983. But already from the early 80s, American Jews took the lead, even before the State of Israel was willing to get involved. And American Jews pushed the State of Israel to be further involved, which led to the various operations in 1984 and 91 to airlift thousands and thousands of Ethiopian Jews to Israel. But if not for American Jewish involvement, that probably never would have happened. Okay, let's talk about Jews fitting in the United States. And I just want to spend a minute giving the example from the world of sports. And I want to give attribution to my Rebbe, Professor Jeffrey Gurak of Yeshiva University, Bernard Reffel Graduate School, who said you can see the level of comfort that American Jews had in America throughout the 20th century on the basis of sports examples. In 1934, and we discussed this, what happened to Hank Greenberg? So we, about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, we discussed Hank Greenberg briefly, and we went together with Bess Meyerson. Hank Greenberg played ball on Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because the pennant was on the line. Hank Greenberg didn't play ball on Yom Kippur. Why? Because he was such a big yid? No, because the pennant was already clinched. So he could afford to take off since nothing was riding on it. The Tigers were going to the World Series. So he could be a good Jew and take a day off and defend his religion when there was really nothing riding on it. Then go to 1965. What happens in 1965? Who takes off?
Sandy Koufax.
Sandy Koufax takes off a World Series game where there's a lot riding on it, namely the World Series, and he's the best pitcher in the game. But unlike Hank, who wasn't willing to do it when there was really anything on the line, Koufax does it, and the popular reaction in the United States favored Koufax. They were not angry with him for allowing his religious baggage to sort of illegitimately override his professional responsibilities. No, the popular reaction among fans of all teams and even non-fans was good for him. It's good to stick up for your religion. So American Jews are getting more comfortable in their own skin in this country. And by the way, the legend has it that Don Drysdale filled in for Koufax in the game that he missed in the 65 World Series against Minnesota. And Drysdale was roughed up and was taken out by Walter Alston, I think, in the fifth inning. And Drysdale supposedly said to Walter Alston, "Hey, Skip, I bet you wish I was Jewish today, too." So I don't know if that's an apocryphal story or not. But then what happened next? 1986. It's October 12th, 1986. The Mets are playing the Astros in the National League Championship Series. The series is tied at 2 games apiece. All right. Mike Scott has easily defeated the Mets twice in games one and game four. Mets won games two and games three. And we're going to game five. Game five is at Shea Stadium. And it was a problem. What's the problem? It's Yontif. Not is it just Yontif, it's Yom Kippur. How could there be a game on Yom Kippur? Well, of course there could be a game on Yom Kippur. There's a game that could be every year. So what are you complaining about? Well, the answer is a lot of Met fans are Jewish. One of the two Met owners, Wilpon, was Jewish. And so there was pressure from season's ticket holders to not have a playoff game on Yom Kippur. As it turned out, who remembers?
Ford.
Was rained out. Game five was rained out. And it was the next day, Doc Gooden versus Nolan Ryan. The Mets won on a single by Gary Carter late in the game in the 12th inning. But it was rained out. But the point is, and Professor Gurak says this, what kind of a chutzpah for the Jews to complain that there can't be a game because of our holiday? This is America, for crying out loud. It's not a Jewish country. Ah, we were so comfortable in our own skin in America that by the 1980s that we could throw our weight around with the season ticket holders and push for a no game on Yom Kippur. Unsuccessfully, but we could try. So that's the sports example of how Jews were uncomfortable, more comfortable, and really comfortable in this country. Okay. Let's talk about for a little bit the fate of the various religious denominations. You know, so over the course of this past year, I really have not spent much time on religious issues because we did it a few years ago with the denominational courses. But I owe it to everybody to speak about the post-war experiences of the various denominations. So let's start with to the left and move our way to the right, always to the right. Start with Reform. The Reform movement in the early post-World War II era was in a position of strength, but not great strength. It was growing because it no longer was catering only to the wealthy German established Jews, but rather it was also catering to Eastern European descendants who had achieved financial success and had moved out into areas of third and fourth settlement. But in doing so, it became necessary to return to ritual. So the old classical Reform Judaism that essentially was opposed and hostile to any and all Judaic ceremonies, shofar, lulav, sukkah, tefillin, yarmulke, talis, you know, overt signs of Judaism, classical Reform was very much anti all of that. Well, post-World War II Reform is going to have to open itself up to these kind of ceremonies in order to compete successfully with conservative Judaism, to attract the attention of and the hearts and minds of the masses of Eastern European Jewish descendants. So eventually, they will be quite successful. Not because Reform theology or ideology was such a winning combination, but just because religion was being so dumbed down in this country that by default, people identified with the flimsiest of all the denominations. In other words, if you were just Jewish and didn't have much Yiddishkeit in your life, but you knew that you had to identify yourself by one of the big three denominations, so even if you were not an active member of a Reform synagogue or even knew what Reform Judaism meant, so in common parlance, what were you? A Reform Jew. When did that actually happen? You know, in my childhood, that was, you know, a standard concept in American Jewish life. If you weren't religious, you were Reform. Well, prior to the 1950s, that wasn't true. Nobody said they were Reform Jew if they weren't. It probably got going in the 60s and into the 70s and reached a high point in the 80s and 90s. But after the 1990s, that concept of, if I'm not religious, I'm a Reform Jew, itself died. And now you have the just Jewish or Jew without religion, or just refusing to identify altogether, bichlal. So the Reform dominance demographically was 80s and 90s, I would say. What sort of major decisions did the Reform movement make in the last 50, 60 years to try to prop itself up? So one thing is, you know, women's ordination. So we spent the whole session on women's ordination, that it begins really in Germany in the 1920s with Regina Jonas, and then in America gets going with Sally Prizand in 1972. Women's ordination saved the Reform movement because men really didn't want to go into the rabbinate, but it was a good job for a Jewish girl. So this was an important thing to keep the attention of people and bring them back into the synagogue, to have the female clergy. The other big thing, we spent a whole session on this a number of years ago, is patrilineal descent. So patrilineal descent was something that was in the works already from 1909, but was not codified until 1947 in the rabbi's manual that children of Jewish fathers could, without a conversion ceremony, become Jews, but they were identified as converts. This was reiterated in the 1961 rabbi's manual. But by the 1970s, the desire on the part of many Reform rabbis was to have such people of Jewish fathers and Gentile mothers be identified as native-born Jews and without the stigma of being a convert, if you want to say there is such a stigma of being a convert. And so Alexander Schindler, Rabbi Alexander Schindler, played the leading role in getting the CCAR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, to put this on their agenda. And in 1983, in March of 83, the decision was made, patrilineal descent. And the very significant impact that that had on American Jewish life was that there were plenty of people now who identified themselves as being Jews who by halachic standards would not be Jewish, but they were unfamiliar with that halachic standard. All they knew was what they were told on the basis of their rabbi, their clergy person. And so this ambiguity, or rather, I wouldn't call it ambiguity, because the person thinks things are entirely clear. It's just that in the opposite direction of what it should be. So this leads to confusion in the matrimonial market and people intermarrying who otherwise would not have been inclined to intermarry. You have many sad cases of people who thought they were marrying a Jewish person and in good faith tried to marry within the tribe, but were guilty of exogamy on account of the patrilineal ruling.
What about the Tikkun Olam philosophy?
Okay, so good. So the role that Tikkun Olam plays in Reform Judaism, and for that matter in Conservative Judaism and Reconstructionist Judaism as well, but primarily Reform, is it gives sort of a Judaic legitimacy to activism that has nothing to do with Judaism. In other words, when you're not fighting for the interests of Klal Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Torat Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, when your cause has nothing to do with any of those things, but is something that you believe is in the best interest of humankind, you can label it Tikkun Olam, and the fact that these are Hebrew words, Tikkun Olam, makes it Jewish. Never underestimate the importance of just throwing around Hebrew phrases to give Judaic legitimacy to political activism engaged in by Jews under the auspices of a religious denomination. But sometimes, of course, what is regarded as Tikkun Olam is contrary to traditional Torah values or traditional Judaic principles. And then you have a clash. On the one hand, say, "Oh, but virtue, great, wonderful thing, good for humanity." On the other hand, it's against the Torah. So, the role Tikkun Olam plays, it plays a pernicious role, to be honest, very often. But not much we can do about it because we're not the ones throwing around that term. There is an attempt made by traditional clergy to try to clarify what the words Tikkun Olam actually mean in the Talmud, to explain that they don't mean what the sort of progressive clergy has claimed that they mean. The real meaning of Tikkun Olam in the Talmud is that there are certain times where the law has a loophole that can result in something detrimental to the interests of society. And Tikkun Olam is a din derabbanan, a rabbinic decree, to close that loophole so that people can't do bad things and hurt others. It doesn't mean repairing the world in some sort of environmental sense, even though it's used in that fashion. Okay, let's go to the conservative movement. The conservative movement, which was very, very successful in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, in capturing the hearts and minds of the post-World War II generation of Eastern European Jewish descendants in the areas of third and fourth settlement. So the rabbis never were on the same page as the lay people. I think I mentioned that a couple of weeks back. The rabbis always regarded themselves as being intellectuals, as having something to contribute to sophisticated cerebral Jewish discourse. And some of them actually did, and some of them were really scholars. But the reality was that most of them were not scholars and most of them had nothing to contribute. But they felt bad about it because they had entered into a so-called learned profession and they were not engaged in learning and their congregants were not engaged in learning. So they had become social workers effectively, not great Tamidei Chachamim, whether in the old world sense or even in the modern sense. So in the conservative movement at the rabbinic level, the big issue to resolve was the Aguna crisis. You know, the Aguna crisis is still around today. It's still around today. And, Instagram is helping the Agunas. In the year 2021, Instagram is the solution to all the Aguna problems. You see these articles in the paper about it. But in the 50s and 60s, the conservative rabbinical assembly wanted to solve this problem once and for all. And they wanted to cooperate with the Orthodox rabbis in achieving some kind of a solution, a joint Beit Din to annul marriages or to facilitate gittin. But it all collapsed. Interdenominational cooperation wasn't meant to be. The joint Beit Din wasn't meant to be. The conservative movement had its Lieberman clause in the ketubah. And eventually in 1970 came to the decision, we'll do hafka'at kiddushin, annulment of marriages. So post-1970, there are no agunas in the conservative movement. If your husband won't give a get, worse comes to worse, they'll annul the marriage. Now, in the Orthodox world, you had the Rachman Beis Din in the late 1990s and tried to pull the same idea, but it was heavily criticized and fell apart. Rabbi Krauss was involved, Rabbi Morgenstern was involved, but it was known as the Rachman Beis Din, and it didn't really go very far. The conservative movement also had to deal with the second day of Yontif. Second day of Yontif was dead. I mean, like deader than dead. And so they decided in 1967 to make it optional. In fact, most conservative shuls did not cancel second day Yontif, but some did, and it was declared officially optional. The 1970s was the big decade for major halachic movement in the conservative denomination. Egalitarian services. There was a big push by the feminists, Ezrat Nashim in 1972 at the Concord Hotel, to push for egalitarianism, and it was a success. So some forward-looking conservative shuls began egalitarian minyan as early as 1973. Most places did not do so until the 80s or 1990s. And I spoke about a couple of years ago why certain shuls held back longer than others. Typically it was because the old rabbi, who often was ordained at Reitz, not at JTS, would simply not go for it. And so you had to wait until he either retired or died to change the character of the shul. Female rabbis, 1983, JTS makes a decision. Amy Eilberg is ordained in 1985. Gay marriage, 2006, led to a fissure in the conservative movement with Joel Roth abandoning the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. And so you've had hot button issues that have torn apart the conservative movement. But they still exist, yet they're in steep decline, and they may suffer an ultimate demise, that the conservative synagogues in certain key suburban areas and urban areas are strong, but only individual synagogues. As a movement, it's basically dead. Okay, let's go to the Orthodox. So Orthodoxy in America was pretty weak in the late 40s, early 50s. The prediction was for the ascendancy of conservative Judaism, and that would become Minhag America, and the Orthodox would disappear from the scene, or they'd be a very marginal group. So that didn't work out. In the end, the day school movement, the yeshivas, expanded exponentially, and the Orthodox camp in America has become the dominant force in American Jewish life, without a doubt, even if it's not numerically, even if the Orthodox group is not yet the majority or even the plurality, it's by far the strongest element within American Jewish life. Chabad. Let's talk about Chabad for a few minutes. So Chabad has, in the post-war era, especially since the 1970s, implanted itself in every Jewish community around the country. Even in places where there was no Jews, you'll find Chabad. It's Chabad on Mars. Why? So the Rebbe had an idea of, you know, reaching out to every last Pintel Yid, every Jewish neshama, and bringing them back into the fold. But what was the influence of Chabad on the synagogue model in the United States? So it had a tremendous impact on the way synagogues operate in certain parts of the country, for better and for worse. For worse, in the sense that Chabad was offering religious services for very little or no commitment. And when I say no commitment, I mean of a financial nature or of a time and effort involvement nature. You could have your bar mitzvah, your life cycle occasion, sort of at the snap of a finger. The shliach will get a Torah and hocus pocus, baruch hu Hashem ha-mavorach, and all of a sudden mazel tov your bar mitzvah for a small fee that's handed over willingly because it's small and it's a lot less than the dues to the local synagogue, whether conservative or Orthodox or Reform. So in that regard, the poaching of members by Chabad from established synagogues can be a real problem for synagogues that are barely hanging on as it is. You know, you send a shliach into a place with a struggling shul, well, that shul is going to go under. And what happens then? There's no house of worship, or Chabad takes over the house of worship in some instances. In other places where the houses of worship are strong, and Chabad is just another option in a wide range of viable options, so that's good. Okay, they're not hurting anyone, and they're offering a service to those who are uncomfortable in the conventional synagogues. So it all depends upon where and exactly how it plays itself out. And hopefully, you know, in some parts of the country, there's harmonious relations between the local clergy and the local shliach, and other places the relationship is terrible. It all depends upon the personalities. Okay, another item which we could spend a long time on, but we won't, but I have to mention it, is the influence of Shlomo Carlebach on American Judaism. If you had to mention just a handful of people who singularly had an influence on American Jewish life, you know, there's the Rebbe, okay, there's, at least among the Orthodox, there was Rabbi Soloveitchik. Among the wider world, there was Heschel, there was Kaplan. Okay, more Shlomo Carlebach. Shlomo Carlebach's music extended to every part of the Jewish world. His own personal circumstances were a little bit unseemly, and he was guilty of certain offenses against the ladies, which were covered up at the time and only came out later on. And certain people want to cancel him from the world of Judaism, from Jewish culture, because of his various sins. But others say, you know, cancel the man, but don't cancel the music. I, as a lover of Chazanut, could do without the music too, because in many ways, Carlebach Nigunim destroyed traditional Nusach in the American synagogue. And although Chazanut was declining anyway, Carlebachian-style davening killed Chazanut. Many of the Orthodox synagogues and conservative synagogues in post-World War II America, suburban America, had a chazan. Wasn't necessarily a famous chazan, but was a zogger chazan, and could daven nicely at the Yomud and do an occasional piece in Uvnucha Yomor, Abavur David, Brich Shmei, Anavda Dekudah Shebarichu. Most places had a chazan. But with the rise of the nigunim that could be sung by anybody with a halfway decent voice, the era of Chazanut ended, and Chazanut became a sort of a specialty thing that survived only in a handful of places in suburbia and in the big cathedral synagogues of Manhattan. I happen to have been lucky to have been an assistant rabbi for some length of time in a place that was the center of Chazanut in America, Cantor Helfgott. But there were only a handful left who were still employed when it, 20, 30 years before, there were many, many more jobs. Okay, what about, Sherry's asking about Debbie Friedman music. So in the world of non-orthodoxy, by the Reform and the Conservative, but especially the Reform, Debbie Friedman was the Shlomo Karbach of her denomination. And her music, especially the Havdalah Nigunim, play a role to Ad Hayom Hazeh, to this very day. And she died too young. So yeah, the music is key to Jewish culture and to sustaining an interest in synagogue services among people who don't have kavana naturally. They don't have real intensity and fervor in actual prayer, but the sound will grab their attention and keep them involved in synagogue life. Okay. Another thing we should mention, in only a handful of minutes we have left, is outreach. Orthodox outreach and even non-Orthodox outreach. Kiruv. So Kiruv has been around from time immemorial. There have been people who tried to bring the wayward back into the fold. But Kiruv in the modern American sense of the term basically begins in the 1970s. What institutions are established, some in the late 60s, but mostly in the 1970s. So you have places like Shar Yashuv in Far Rockaway. You have NJOP, National Jewish Outreach Program, in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, associated with Lincoln Square, Rabbi Buchwald. You have, later on, you'll have Gateways. You'll have, later on, you'll have MJE, the Beginner Services in all these different places, NCSY for the youth, and among the non-Orthodox, the important work done by USY. So this is an important aspect of American Judaism because it showed that it's not one downward spiral away from religious life, that you can bring people back in not insignificant numbers. I mean, not tremendous numbers. Still, the overall trend is assimilatory, but you can save the souls and build them back up for religion. What about the impact of Art Scroll and Daf Yomi? So that's what Gideon is asking in the chat. The answer is Art Scroll was critical to the day school movement actually producing people who were fairly learned in the sense that the earlier years, the day schools tried their best, but without good translations, people didn't have entree into the more sophisticated types of Talmudic, Judaic and Talmudic learning. Cencino was terrible. The old translations were terrible. You couldn't really learn with them. Steinsaltz, for those who understood Hebrew, was a nice way into the Talmud. And I remember learning with the Hebrew Steinsaltz before Art Scroll had made all their Gemaras with the Schottenstein. But Art Scroll, first with the Megillas Esther, followed by the Siddur, followed by the Machzorim, followed by the Chumashim, and then lastly the Shas Bavli under Schottenstein, was of incalculable significance in raising the standard of Jewish and Talmudic knowledge among the masses. Daf Yomi would have been impossible without the Schottenstein. Simply impossible. Yes, in the old days there was Daf Yomi, but how many people went to the Siyum HaShas in 1930, in 1938, in 1945, 53, 60, before 1990 at Madison Square Garden, all the prior Siyumim were small affairs. In the Beis Yaakov of Borough Park, they would have 1,000 people. So how did we get to MetLife Stadium, Madison Square Garden, Nassau Coliseum, 1997 I went to? The answer is good translations. Massive difference in the way learning occurred. Okay. But in the last few minutes, we'll give the downside, the assimilation factor, intermarriage and the like. So what's destroying American Judaism for the masses of American Jews? A few things. Number one, the general secularization of society. Jews are not immune to it. It's happening to everybody else. It'll happen to Jews too. But the lack of Hebrew knowledge, I think, played an important role. In other Jewish communities around the world, where Zionist influence is greater, people learn Hebrew. Your average American Jew can't string together a sentence in grammatically correct Hebrew. And I'm talking about people even who went to Talmud Torah, and sometimes even who went to day school. It's embarrassing, that the lack of Hebrew knowledge. So this means, number one, a disconnect from Israel, which is bad because, you know, anti-Zionism and anti-Israelism is rampant in this day and age. So if you as a Jew don't have that linguistic connection to Israel, it's a struggle to identify fully. But also it means you can't learn the Chumash, you can't learn the Talmud, you can't learn this, you can't read the Siddur properly, or you can't understand the Siddur properly. That Jews are Judaically illiterate. The educational system failed. We sent our kids to Harvard and Yale, but couldn't get them to read a Hebrew sentence. That was a big, big blunder by American Jews. And in other countries, it wasn't that way. In other countries, Jews are better about educating their kids in Hebrew and Judaism. Intermarriage, the big bogeyman, was at 50% or 52% according to the 1990 survey, is at 70% according to the 2020 survey. Why? Well, I mean, when Jews are only 2% of the population and you want to get married, so most of your choices out there aren't Jewish. And gone is the era when a young person will feel guilty about their choice to marry out of the faith. Not yet gone is the heartache for the parental generation seeing their child do it, but the kid is no longer with the pangs of guilt. I remember when I was in Manhattan, so I used to go running in the mornings in Central Park. A little anecdote to end our year. And one of the guys from the shul from Park East we used to run with me. And the other guys were all Jewish, but lived on the West Side and were not synagogue affiliated. But he knew them from the business. And one of them said to me, because he was intermarried and his parents were upset about it, he said, it's the biggest double standard in all of Manhattan. Biggest double standard that they raise their children to be such liberals and to be open to all things and all people. But you bring home the wrong girl and they're ready to cut you out of the will. And that will was substantial, I tell you. So he said, it's the biggest double standard. That they don't care. For 30 years, you can do whatever you want. You can eat a treat cheeseburger on Yom Kippur. But you bring home the wrong girl, you're out. And he didn't understand why that was their attitude. And you know what? I don't blame him, because I'm sure the parents also couldn't explain themselves. They were following their kishkas, you know, what their gut feeling tells them. But the gut feeling of indifference to Judaism and all matters except for intermarriage is not really intellectually coherent. It's just something a sentiment. But sentiment only lasts one or two generations. It doesn't last indefinitely. Okay, so what has been done to try to reverse the trends of declining birth rate, high rate of assimilation, high rate of intermarriage, absence of Hebrew facility, turning against Israel among Jews? So obviously Orthodox Kiruv brings people closer to religion, but not everybody's ready for Shmirah Shabbos and religion. So birthright Israel and other activities designed to engage young Jews in Jewish life without hitting them over the head with onerous halachic observance is something that has been a prominent feature of Jewish life in the last 20 to 25 years. Has it had any success? The answer is yes. I would say it does have some success, that there are people who are not necessarily keeping kosher and observing Shabbos to the T, but who are more closely aligned with the interests of the Jewish people and take Jewish interests seriously, where absent these efforts, they would have been completely lost and out in the yonder. So it does help, but only at the margins, only at the margins. For the most part, the decline in indifference continues apace. Okay, with this, I will close. I'll take a couple of questions and then we'll bid each other farewell.
Hi, I want to thank you for a great class. My wife and I loved it and look forward to
thank
it
you, Eli.
Every Monday night.
Thank you. We're going to be back on to Tuesdays. Next year, we're going back in person, Woodmere on Tuesdays.
Oh, in person? That's great.
Yes, Anshe Shalom will be Monday nights at 7, And Young Israel of Woodmere will be Tuesday nights back at 8:15 in person.
Great.
Rabbi, the question, the conservative and the egalitarianism. Not of great Judaic significance other than increasing the market share.
Okay, so egalitarianism was about several things. Number one, placating a special interest group within the movement that could not be ignored. Secondly, sustaining minyanim by doubling the potential participants in that minyan for shuls that were struggling to have one. Well, now you have much greater options in terms of securing your 10 people. And lastly, it was a solution to an intellectual difficulty and an incongruity that mitzvah had been on the rise for 25 years, including the participation. But that was a one-off, not to be followed by subsequent involvement in the liturgical life of the synagogue. Well, how do you justify that? How do you tell a 12-year-old girl, you can read a Haftorah today, but by the way, never again? It doesn't make any sense. So egalitarianism was an inevitable follow-up, secondary move after the rise of the bat mitzvah.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Hi. Two things I want to say, comments on. I think, you know, when you speak about the demise of the Chazonot, which I happen to love, okay, yeah. It's in part due because this younger generation can't wait to get home or do what they want to do. They don't have the zitschfleisch to sit
yes,
down.
Yes, you're right, you're
and
right.
Listen to a beautiful melody, you know, and see how it really can move them. And right. To them, a good voice is a good voice. It's that doesn't have currency.
So some people blame the Young Israel movement for this. That they say
talk about that.
I disagree.
Wait a minute. Let me say the whole thing. Okay. Yeah. I don't want to talk. The Young Israel movement didn't have chazans. They had a Baal Tefillah.
Right.
And when I grew up in the Young Israel movement where there were no chazans. But right. My father kept records from Yossel and
Of course.
So he loved that, but he had to make a choice, you see, because right. Young Israel didn't provide that. That's number one. And I think it's a whole issue about this generation in general, who have no patience with these things. As far as poaching is concerned, you didn't speak about the stabilization of America, that there are people who do not support a main institution, but I think on a Rebbe's shtiebel, you know, and it's not Chabad, it's just a shtiebel.
Right. Okay? Right. Yeah.
You know, so if you got to be even, you know, when it comes to that. Plus the fact that I think, you know, a community I come from, I think shuls in general, the institutional shuls, can be very boring. They're not exciting. They don't do exciting programs.
Right.
And Chabad answers a lot of these problems. They do exciting problems. No.
And they also prompt the institutional synagogue to get its act together and do the...
Exactly. So in Great Neck, you have a beautiful JCC now that addresses the needs of people who want to play basketball, and they may be going to public school, and then they affiliate in the basketball court, informal education.
Right.
And they also have resources for special children, you know, like a friendship circle.
JCC has been done by Chabad.
You know, I remember I worked for the, I remember I worked for Federation, capacity of a social worker. And we were trying to get mentors together with children to help them, etc. They gave me such a runaround because... of, you know, we live in a litigation society. So
litigious.
And this and that. Chabad comes with a friendship circle, you know?
Yeah.
Easy, done, finished.
Done. You're right.
So there are a lot of...
Just one thing, just if I may just put in one thing, I think that I do agree with you to an extent as far as the Chazanish, but if you go back to the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, what was the basis of entertainment for many of these people who would come in as immigrants, and the lack of TV, for example, the lack of internet?
Chazonos was entertainment.
Exactly. And what happened is, what you are speaking of, is that if you go back only 20 years or something, you still have that generation that's been trained that way.
Right.
But we don't have that exposure to the entertainment. So I really don't blame, Kaulbach, because I think that would be an inevitable demise of the popularity of Chazanish.
Yeah, you're right.
If okay, if we could have some summer homework, what's going to be this?
Okay, good. So I'm going to mute everybody, and I'm going to give my parting instructions. So our next season, we're going to do the history of anti-Semitism. It probably will take us the full year. We'll see, but certainly at least in the fall, we're going to do a history of anti-Semitism. And there's a question in the chat: is Israel Scarsdale going to participate in next year's lecture series? The answer is I am under the impression that the Tuesday night classes in Woodmere will be broadcast on Zoom or on the internet somehow, so you'll be able to see those. Whether I'll be in person in Scarsdale in the fall, I have yet to speak to Rabbi Morgenstern about that, so that's still up in the air. I'm not sure yet, but I hope the answer to that is yes. So I'll let everybody know. Last but not least, my book is now available for sale, Parsha Themes and Historical Perspective. Okay, here we go, Parsha Themes and Historical Perspective. Sunday night, this coming Sunday night at Anshi Shalom in New Rochelle, there'll be a book event, 7 p.m. There will be an event at Young Israel of Scarsdale on August 10th. And there'll be an event at Great Neck Synagogue sometime in late August to be determined. And hopefully at Young Israel Woodmere late August to be determined.
Okay.
Stay tuned for more information on that.
All right, who's the publisher?
Huh? The publisher is Geffen Publishing.
Is it available online?
It's available on Amazon, but you can buy it from me directly at any of the events that I'm having going forward. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful summer. I'll see you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, bye.